You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Coming up on today's programme, so Richard Sharp resigns as BBC chairman, we'll discuss. And also, should the rules around lobbying change?
Well, first, bad news if you're a football or Eurovision fan. Rail unions have rejected a pay offer from the government, which means that new strike dates are potentially going to clash with both competitions. Four more days of industrial action are planned for May and June. The government says that its pay offer was fair and reasonable. Same old, same old. But teachers as well are balloting for more strikes. That could mean coordinated walkouts of teachers. And we know, Caroline, already that the teacher strikes are more harmful to the economy than the rail strikes. We saw that in the latest GDP data. And separately, we know that a UK court has told nurses that their plans for more walkouts must end a day early. So lots and lots of news on the strike front.
Yeah, absolutely. And today is actually another teachers' strike day. In terms of other stories, though, that we're watching out for. I remember the Brexit bonfire. Apparently, it's been extinguished. So back in 2016, Brexiters were arguing that leaving the European Union wasn't all about the economy. It was also about sovereignty, of course, breaking free of the shackles of Brussels. They wanted to get rid of a lot of the laws on the statute books as a hangover. A Brexit bonfire of regulations was the prize. But now, Kemi Badenoch, the business and trade secretary, has told a committee of MPs this week that the government's actually going to break that promise. It's not going to manage to get rid of these thousands of EU laws by the end of this year. The Telegraph newspapers reported on this. The numbers that it has reported is that it's only about in the hundreds of laws that are going to be swept aside.
You'll remember that we actually had this story at Bloomberg back in November, that you had civil servants warning that this target, this target of the government's was unachievable. Here it is. It's going to make
and
those
arbitrary, right? And very difficult if you then don't replace some of that legislation with, you know, whatever framework you want to replace it with, then that's tricky. So, yeah, interesting that the bonfire no longer.
Yeah, and it's going to make those hardline Brexiters who are already tearing their hair out about Rishi Sunak's Windsor framework, the New Deal on Northern Ireland, even angrier, because this was supposed to be, as you say, one of the big Brexit dividends.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I mean, it's sort of related in terms of Brexit benefits, whether the UK could get a trade deal, that mirage of a trade deal with the United States. Ron DeSantis is visiting the UK. He's been on a big trade deal. The governor of Florida, he's only been to four countries, and the last stop is the UK. It's really interesting. Of course, he hasn't declared yet whether he's going to be a presidential candidate, but he's widely expected to try to run as the Republican candidate. And also the UK's got big ties with Florida, so he's going to be meeting some senior ministers in the UK.
Yeah, James Cleverly and Kemi Badenoch. It's a well-trodden path for would-be presidential nominees, but I don't know how this is going to go down with Donald Trump. I think British diplomats will be treading very carefully so as not to upset him if he becomes the next US president. And I'm sure that, as you say, Kemi Badenoch's going to want to raise the prospects of a UK-US trade deal, not just a state-by-state deal.
Yeah, absolutely. He's travelling with his wife, Casey, also with their children. They were in South Korea, in Japan and Israel before. I didn't really know this until Ron DeSantis said it a number of times on his trip, that Florida has the 15th largest economy in the entire world.
I'm thinking out loud here, Caroline. But if we can negotiate with states on an individual basis in the US, why did we have to leave the European Union
to do this?
I know we weren't a state of the EU, but
yeah, no, absolutely.
You see my thinking.
I do. And yet, I think it's also an important moment, a very important US figure over here in the UK. Right, let's talk about then what's happening with the BBC. So, Richard Sharpe has resigned as BBC chairman after an official inquiry that found that he had breached rules by failing to disclose ties to the Conservative Party leadership. The government appointments watchdog has commissioned an independent probe after it emerged that he helped to arrange a loan of as much as £800,000 for the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a loan which wasn't publicly disclosed during his application for the top BBC job. So to discuss more, we're joined by Thomas Seal, Bloomberg's London-based tech, media and telecoms reporter. Sharpe didn't quit, Thomas, when this was initially reported by the Sunday Times. What did the official inquiry find that actually shifted this situation and meant that he's gone?
So the technical breach, which seems to have been fatal, is that Sharpe didn't disclose something which leads to a potential perceived conflict of interest. This is the bureaucratic language that the lawyer has used. Effectively, Sharpe did tell one senior official, the cabinet secretary, Simon Case, but he didn't tell the panel interviewing him for the BBC job, which he should have done. Sharpe didn't resign at first because he maintains that this was an inadvertent breach of the rules and it was not material. However, the reason he's changed his mind is partly the huge story it's created. It's just pressure. He doesn't say that, of course. And he says it could be a distraction, effectively, from his job running the BBC.
Does this have blowback for Simon Case, then?
Well, I think there will be questions about Mr. Case's role. Then again, I think Sharpe was the man with the obligation. I haven't read the full governance code, but certainly Case has probably not relished becoming a protagonist in this story. Let's put it that way.
We've had two Fridays then with huge news in a row. Last week, the Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab resigning over bullying. Does Sharpe's resignation help or hinder Sunak, given his promise to run a government based on integrity and accountability?
It's fascinatingly close, isn't it? Sharpe was Sunak's boss when they worked together at Goldman Sachs. He helped the government during COVID as a special advisor, unpaid, but had previously donated £400,000 to the Conservative Party many years ago. And so I think, in a way, Sharpe's resignation takes some pressure off Sunak to do anything, to act. There'll be questions about who his replacement as BBC chairman will be. They'll have to find someone who doesn't attract the same level of questions about links to the Tory party. But it is the prerogative of the party in power to appoint their own people to a certain extent. And we've seen this as well with the chairman of Ofcom, who was a Tory, who is now a crossbench peer. So both parties do it. But I think particularly under Boris Johnson, this became a real issue.
Yeah, it looks murky whether he jumped or Sunak pushed him. I mean, where does it leave the BBC and its claim to impartiality?
Yeah, it's such a eternal debate in the BBC where the chairman is appointed by the government, but it's got to be independent. The Labour Party has said that this has really damaged the perceptions around the BBC, and there's been a roiling debate from people who have left the BBC and gone into the private sector, people like Emily Maitlis, accusing the BBC of being unduly influenced by a fellow called Robbie Gibb, who's joined the BBC board, but before that, his role was the spokesperson for Theresa May. So there's a sort of a perception of a revolving door, and I think the BBC needs to work hard to move past it. It's not going to be easy.
So then in terms of runners and riders as to the successor to Richard Sharp, I mean, the idea is that it would be someone from the handful of people on the board who would take over it temporarily. But again, those have some influence from government, don't they, in terms of who those individuals are?
Yes, so they will run another process now. I think in the immediate, so for the next 2 months, Sharp will remain on the board. There is one sort of Tory-linked person on the board, which is this fellow Robbie Gibb. It would be a big story if they choose him as the replacement. I personally think that's unlikely, but you never know. And there are some more sort of broadcasting experts. It could be another external appointment. I'm not sure exactly. In terms of runners and riders, there are lots of media figures with links to the party, but yeah, I'm not going to go out on a limb and speculate. I think they need to play it safe with this next person.
Well, we'll be getting you straight back on the podcast if it's Robbie Gibb. Thank you so much, Thomas Seal. That's our London-based tech, media, and telecoms reporter, Thomas Seal. Thank you. Now, the issue of lobbying has become increasingly problematic after a year which has seen multiple former cabinet ministers say they would accept money for influence. And this week's gambling white paper was surrounded by allegations of inappropriate lobbying that were then denied. Add to that the near collapse of one of Britain's biggest business lobbying groups, the CBI. And do we need new rules around lobbying? To discuss, joining us now is Head of Public Relations and Policy at the Chartered Institute of Public Relations, John Gurlis. John, thanks so much for being with us. You published a paper this week on what that reform should look like. Just explain for us what you think should be done. Is Parliament taking this issue seriously enough?
Thanks, Lizzie. Well, we've had 2 years of lobbying scandals hitting the headlines and the front pages. And following those scandals, we've had a number of reports and inquiries looking into the issue of lobbying and some of the issues surrounding lobbying, all of which have come to the conclusion that the rules around lobbying are just not fit for purpose. And yet, despite that, the report that we put out earlier this week, called A Never-Ending Scandal, shows that Parliament actually very rarely take this issue quite seriously. There's occasional conversations about it at the time of scandal, and then they quickly fall away again. And what we're saying now is actually for the government to take this issue seriously. There's an election coming up. The report that we published also included some public polling, and this stuff is cutting through, and it is making its way into the minds of voters. And what we're saying is that whilst it might not be an immediate doorstep issue, it certainly is going to influence the kind of conversations that MPs or prospective MPs have on the doorstep. So we do need new rules, absolutely.
Yeah, we've just been talking about Richard Sharp quitting as BBC chairman. It just adds to the murk, doesn't it, around government?
Well, it does. But then I'll push back against John. Neither party's going to go for tougher rules when it comes to lobbying because, let's say, the Times revealed last month a Conservative MP offered to table parliamentary questions, leak confidential policy documents, lobby ministers on behalf of the gambling industry. And on the other side, you have Labour front benchers taking significant donations and from private donors for staffing and office costs. Names like Yvette Cooper, David Lammy, Wes Streeting,
and Rachel Reeves.
And Rachel Reeves. So neither party has an interest, do they, in making the rules significantly more difficult?
Well, I would argue actually a lot of those points you've just put forward are probably an argument for good lobbying and for good lobbying rules. Ideally, where decisions of government or even those in opposition are made, should come as a result of good lobbying rather than just people that you know or contacts in your little black book or business interests that you might have outside of Parliament. What we're saying is lobbying is an incredibly important part of our democratic, of our democracy. And what we want to see is actually a degree of transparency and accountability. Now, the government did take this seriously because they commissioned the Nigel Boardman to look at this, the issue of lobbying following the Green Seal scandal. That report was published about a year ago or so. Nothing's happened from that. The government also instructed the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee to look into the Lobbying Act, the rules and the legislation around lobbying as well. So it's an issue that is being taken seriously. And as I said at the start, it's an issue that now a number of recommendations, reports, campaign groups like the CIPR and others have simply said that is not working and changes are required.
But John, turkeys don't vote for Christmas. Politicians want to win power. Realistically, this is the money that oils the wheels that gets them there. Specifically, what would you change to make this realistically work better?
So at the moment, the legislation means that we have a register of consultant lobbyists. That means third-party lobbyists that can lobby on behalf of a client or another organisation are required to register. At the moment, that means that there's only 251, I believe, organisations on the register, and it captures estimates, say, about 4% of lobbying activity that happens in this country. When you compare it to other international registers, we are lacking behind the likes of the EU, the US, Canada, Spain, Slovenia, Peru, Mexico, Germany, the Netherlands, Ireland, Scotland, and countless others. Lobbying registers do work in other countries. In fact, we're one of the few that doesn't count in-house lobbyists, so those people and lobbyists that work for organisations. And there's absolutely no requirement for them to register at all. In fact, Transparency International put out their data in terms of who's been meeting with departments. And of all the top 10 lobbyists, none of them are required to register on the Westminster register. So we're calling for a widening of the register. We want a register of lobbyists, of lobbying, and not a register of lobbyists. And I think, like I say, it's a situation that seems to work fairly well in other countries. We're the outlier to that at the moment.
Do you think that the near collapse, I'll say, of the CBI could change matters? I mean, they are, you know, from our perspective, thinking about kind of business, they are clearly a hugely important voice. And indeed, they, you know, sort of sell themselves, pride themselves on the fact that they are able, as the voice of business, to kind of gain access to ministers, and rightly so, surely, on many topics. Do you think, though, that the CBI, facing the difficulties, you know, that it does, its own internal issues, do you think that that change could provide a kind of fresh window?
I'm not sure. I mean, lobbying is a discipline where the intention of the activity is to inform and influence public policy and law. Wherever there will be people making decisions on regulations, on legislation, then there will always be people looking to influence those decisions. And it's not just a case of influencing it for personal gain. As I said at the beginning, lobbying provides an incredibly important part of our democracy. It provides detailed information to parliamentarians who are time poor and haven't got the staff maybe necessarily to get really into the detail of a particular policy decision. Now, there are business groups and trade associations and private organisations that will meet and do that on a regular basis. Whatever that looks like and whoever's doing it, I think it's very important that policy decision makers continue to keep those lines of communication open. And it will continue one way or another, whether there's business representative groups or individual businesses going to do that. I don't think it changes the landscape. What we're really saying is, actually, it's not so much a case of the fact that lobbying is going to stop or change. It's the fact that the rules need to become clearer so that there's a degree of transparency and accountability so that businesses know when they do lobby, they have to be slightly more transparent about it.
But I feel like partly the point is the onus isn't just on MPs, it's also on those who are lobbying. Because what has annoyed so many about the CBI is the perceived hypocrisy that it was demanding such high ethical standards of its members, of the government, when it is alleged it's having problems at home.
Absolutely. And your point about the responsibility being on both sides is completely accurate. There's lobbying as a two-way street. It takes absolutely two people to engage in lobbying, the lobbied and the lobbyist. And it's absolutely right that business should accept its responsibilities when it comes to I think adhering to a certain amount of transparency. I mean, we're not talking in some of the other countries and international registers I mentioned where there is necessarily copious amounts of detail attached to those, but simply just a record and the ability to put yourselves into the public frame when it comes to the fact that you are legitimately and rightly seeking to engage and influence politicians.
Are you concerned, just lastly, at the Chartered Institute of Public Relations, that actually the fact that the lobbying rules are so lax and there have been such a large number of scandals is actually damaging the industry? Is that the drive for trying to create better standards?
It absolutely does do that. The reputation of although there's a saying that public relations practitioners like to use, where there's another lobbying scandal that doesn't involve a lobbyist, I think as far as the public goes, they don't distinguish between the two. Our members and the industry at large takes its responsibilities incredibly seriously. And when it comes to agencies or firms or consultancies lobbying, they already have to put themselves onto the register. So there's absolutely a good argument to say that this isn't just a case of doing the right thing. It's actually about making sure that politicians understand the value of reputation and trust, that the industry is able to put itself forward and understands those matters too. And ultimately it's for the benefit of the public as well. So really we're trying to improve the landscape when it comes to our politics and the reputation of our politics for all the players in it.
Okay, John Gurlis, Head of Public Relations and Policy at the Chartered Institute of Public Relations. Really, really fascinating to talk to you about the issue of lobbying.
Now, it's been almost 8 months since Queen Elizabeth II passed away and King Charles III was elevated to the throne. Next weekend, we'll see the formal events marking his coronation, an event that has not happened in the UK in 70 years. To discuss, we are joined in studio by Bloomberg reporter Louise Moon. Of course, we're less than a week away now from the coronation. What are the events planned for the coronation bank holiday weekend? We get two bank holiday weekends in a row.
I know, very exciting. Well, as I say, it's a whole weekend of plans. So the actual day is on Saturday, that's May 6th. And that will all centre around the coronation. So it's a religious event. It's an ancient rite of passage, given that the monarch is the head of the state and the head of the Church of England. Mm. So the exact details about the day are yet to be released. But what we know is that the king will join a procession from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Abbey, and that's where the service will take place. That's expected to last about 1.5 hours. It will have about 2,200 guests, led by the Archbishop of Canterbury. He'll be crowned there, and Camilla, the Queen Consort, will also be crowned, and then there'll be a bigger procession back to Buckingham Palace. So that's the key main day. And then, as you say, there's a whole weekend. So on Sunday, there's a concert. So it's the first ever concert in Windsor Castle. So 5,000 people have been given a free ticket to go to that. And I think, from memory, Katy Perry is playing, which is very exciting. And then on Monday, King Charles has promoted a whole day of helping out, essentially, so volunteering. So he's encouraging the whole country to go out and volunteer, whatever, in whatever form that may be.
Because he's been passionate about charity work all his life and his very long wait to be king. So it sounds like lots going on. Will it actually boost the UK economy?
So in terms of hospitality and tourism, it is expected to provide a boost. So for tourism, for example, domestic bookings are said to be up, and as well as international tourists. So bookings from the US, for example, are up 10% compared to pre-pandemic, at the same period in pre-pandemic. Hospitality is also expected to get a £350 million boost. That's people flocking to pubs, to restaurants. They've got, obviously, as we say, an extra day's holiday. Licensing hours have been extended from 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. So they've got a lot more hours of drinking, buying beers, buying curries maybe. And that's in added sales. So more than what retailers would expect over an average weekend. Slight caveat that this is a bit less than the expected sales from the Jubilee. So Charles potentially isn't bringing in as much as his mother's Jubilee did. And obviously it comes at a welcome time. You know, energy bills are at a record high, it's higher borrowing costs, double-digit inflation. So this will be a very welcome boost for hospitality. But at the same time, obviously, a bank holiday means one less day of working in the UK.
Yes, so, that's problematic for GDP.
Exactly. So Bloomberg Economics said that on balance, it will cost the UK economy about $2 billion. So even though we've got, you know, boost to hospitality, boost to tourism, as a whole, it won't necessarily be beneficial for the economy.
Okay. Who is attending? Because it's also sort of seen as obviously very important for Britain on the world stage, and all of these high profile people coming to the UK.
Yeah, quite exciting. We'll have hopefully lots of famous people flocking to the UK. But so it's a lot less. If we were to compare it to Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, it's a lot smaller. So as I said, it's about 2,000 guests, and she had about over 8,000 roughly for hers. We don't know the full extent of the guest list, but there are a few people that have confirmed or not confirmed. So Biden won't be coming, but he's sending his wife, so she will be coming along. And obviously it was all over the papers that Meghan Markle won't be attending. It's their son's birthday, apparently, over the same weekend. But Harry is coming. And then aside from that, lots of heads of state, government representative, tons of MPs and other dignitaries. So it'll be a big event from global leaders flocking to the UK.
Although also the possibility of protests, of Republican anti-monarchist protests, I think it'll be an interesting one. Louise, thank you so much for being with us. Bloomberg reporter Louise Moon. We will have much more, of course, in terms of coronation coverage for you next week on Bloomberg UK Politics.
Well, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock, and our audio engineer was Maruful Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepker.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. We'll be back with more next week. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.